Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I'll tell you, it's one of those things that I've been talking about for, well, probably all 16 years I've been doing this show, that you get those construction jobs, those building trades jobs. Those are solid wage, family-sustaining jobs with excellent benefit, retirement, all kinds of stuff. It's the kind of economy we want to have. It's the kind of economy heavily unionized, make sure people have rights on the job, make sure that they're paid a reasonable wage. They're great jobs. And as you said, look, some of the linemen, they're making six figures. That's the kind of economy that you want to build. You don't want to build an economy off of people making $2.83 an hour or 86 or whatever the Pennsylvania state minimum wage for restaurant workers is. You want to build an economy on high-wage jobs, not exploitable, desperate, low-wage jobs. And sadly, what the pandemic showed us is we've got way too many of those kind of jobs. We gave nice titles, essential, called them heroes, all that stuff, only to underpay them, cheat them, and now we find it's getting even worse. I'm here to share some thoughts on just how bad the inequality has gotten in America. And their ongoing series on inequality in America. I've asked Marcus Barham to come talk with us. Marcus is the special project editor over at Capital in Maine. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Rick. I'm in a car, so I hope it's quiet enough for you.
So here, I'm looking at this story that you guys just put out. Story of a school teacher who, again, we're a lot of people beating up on school teachers because they don't want to go rushing back into an unsafe classroom. And you look at a lot of states across the country, these are really poverty wage jobs and we're paying people poverty wages and entrusting them with our most valuable resource, our kids, the future of this country. It seems insane.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was a school teacher in New York in the early 90s. And I had to work extra jobs just to do anything beyond pay the rent. And I talk to teachers now in New York, where they're a little better paid, but especially in states like Florida, which has one of the lowest salaries for teachers of any state. And they all have to do extra jobs. Like you see in the story, in that example, they both teachers, one older and one a younger teacher, both had to work extra jobs. Just to bring an income. So they're working two or three jobs just to keep up, and they're doing, like you said, the most important job in the world.
Yeah, and as you point out in your piece, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they found out of all of the OECD countries, the U.S. had the largest, this is your words, the largest salary gap between teachers and other workers with comparable training. And, hey, we're number one.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's kind of stunning. I mean, it's not too surprising when you look at other examples, but a lot of it is that even though teachers are unionized in the U.S., the unions don't have that much power, and so they don't have much clout. And you see it overseas where the unions are, much more powerful, especially teachers' unions, and they can, demand and get those salaries they deserve, where people who graduate from the best schools in Germany and in France and other places go into teaching. They don't go onto Wall Street. I mean, some do. They don't automatically, go into business or law, but they go into teaching, and it's a respected job.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
I've had a bunch of people over the years say, well, the reason that it's not a respected job is because overwhelmingly it's a job done by women. Is that something you've heard, something you believe, something you think?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a sexist element there. I mean, in terms of generally teachers are considered the women, that's the job you think of, is it female teachers. And I'm sure that's a factor. Another factor is, I think, for many years, it was a job for slightly educated women who served this essential function. It's like, okay, we have these, kids you got to teach. It's not the most important. You don't have to be super trained to do it, even though the challenges have increased exponentially I remember when I was teaching, you know, you had to deal with, I was teaching up in Harlem, and there were all kinds of issues that you had to deal with, be sort of a social worker at the same time. Things that didn't really happen, you know, when teachers first started to, public schools first started to, you know, open up in the start of the century and in the 19th century, and when it was almost all women, and they were just taking whoever was barely trained or out of high school, or not even high school, somebody who at least could competently lead a group of kids. So the needs, you know, haven't been, they're not being met with salaries that equal those.
Yeah.
Those demands.
No, and again, it comes back down to, I would argue, bargaining power. A lot of states have laws that limit what teachers' unions can bargain over. And you know, again, they play between the rules. And that's been a huge, really a huge win for conservatives over the years, is limiting what unions can bargain over and what teachers, especially teachers' union and public sector workers, our workers are able to bargain over, to where it's almost to the point where, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, look what happened in Wisconsin. I was just reading about that, doing some research today, and you forget how, you remember in 2011, Scott Walker's bill, which completely undercut public sector workers.
Yep.
And most of it was aimed at teachers. I mean, that teachers made up like a large component of those public sector workers. And their salaries went down.
Plummeted.
Because all of a sudden they had to pay for their own benefits.
No, no, so I was there. I spent 10 days sleeping on the granite floor, the marble floor.
There you go.
You know, in February in Wisconsin, you know, and they did. They rammed it through like thieves in the night, and it was never anything he ran on. But boy, you know, he sure stuck it to those people. And now Wisconsin, which had been at the top end of education, has found themselves somewhere near the middle to the bottom of the pack.
Right. Right, so you had that example, and then you had obviously what happened in Kansas with Sam Brownback, and how, you know, teachers there were like starving, and you know, the populace finally revolted, and it, you know, it also impacted Florida. So under Rick Scott, and now under DeSantis, who finally actually pushed for a pay increase, but not a very big pay increase, but under Rick Scott, you know, it was very difficult for teachers, and it really made it difficult for anyone there in that state to make it, even after being a teacher for 10, 20 years. And that was kind of like the point of the story, I think, was that not only to address the crisis of teachers not being paid well and that their wages have remained stagnant, but to look for a place like, you know, Florida, which is considered, you know, not a poor state by any measure, and yet that they pay their teachers so poorly. I mean, worse than what you'd think of in Mississippi or Alabama. In those states that you think of as poverty stricken.
Yeah, I was looking at the story, and I was going, and I stopped it. I reread the story a couple of times because you put the starting number of this guy somewhere. What was it was like $9,000 or $10,000 or something?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's comparable to that. I don't have it in front of me. It was something along those lines, and that they have, you know, the increase. It's barely increased. So he, you know, has been there teaching for a few years and hasn't really seen much of an increase. And the other woman in the story, Marianne, she has been teaching. She used to teach up in Vermont, where in the 70s she could afford a nice home and a nice life with her family. And now she's in Florida and she's like, you know, in her 60s and has to work extra jobs and is being paid comparably, you know, less than what she was making in Vermont 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I
so
mean,
that's a shame.
That is a shame.
More than a shame. It's outrageous.
But here's the thing. There are a lot of workers out there who are going, well, because I just saw it. I apologize. I was looking at the wrong number. In Florida, you've got that they rank 30th in the nation with an average starting salary just over $38,000. You look at the average working person in this country who hasn't seen a raise in 40 years, really. Their standard of living has actually gone backwards. And what's been done masterfully to us is you've seen people pitted against one another. You know, the taxpayers have to pay their salaries, so we're gonna squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. So that means the teachers don't get raises. Education takes a hit. It's this snowballing downward of standard of living for everybody. It's kind of like the Hunger Games, but at the top, you still got the Bezoses right. and the Bloombergs and the billionaire class who've walked away quite handsomely.
Right, and that's one thing that we're reporting actually this week. I'm reporting on this week and next week is, I mean, some of the increases that have happened, like in the last 6 months, 7 months, there have been some increases because of the supply and demand and the workforce, and you've seen like low end workers, cafeteria workers. Restaurant chefs and waiters and busboys and such and grocery store workers get increases and sometimes dramatic increases, and yet those have all been kind of wiped out because of inflation. So the cost of living has wiped out a lot of those gains. And even if there wasn't that inflation, that basically makes those wage increases negligible to some extent. Even if that wasn't there, it's still doesn't really make up for the historical lack of wage increases, where these people who are making, I was just talking to a union rep in L.A., talking about how the workers there, I think retail workers are making, like, they get about $24, or the hotel maids and the housekeepers get about $24, now $25 an hour, and that was a big increase to fight for that. And that those people, if you look at that sector, their wages have remained so low over the last 20, 30 years, they should be at a much higher level, like either in the 30s or 40s per hour.
Yeah.
And they're not. So these piecemeal increases are kind of lauded by the press, I hate to say it, and by, of course, conservatives then use that to say, well, look, who needs minimum wage increases? Because, the private sector is already giving these people salary increases and the market's, functioning effectively.
Yeah. See, I go the other way with that. I go, we're in a moment right now where, okay, everybody's about $15 an hour. Why not raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour? Because it's probably not going to go back. And the only ones that are going to try and claw it back are the most unscrupulous, low-wage employers that we really shouldn't want to begin with.
Right. That's absolutely true. And that's not really a way to be at the whims of the market, which is, of course, going to, always look for the lowest wage they can attract somebody. And finally, now they have a situation where people are being able to be selective and say, you know what, that job I was doing, stocking shelves, that sucks. I'm going to look for something better. And that's good, except you have to worry about inflation, which luckily is going down a little bit, in recent weeks. It's hardly going to make up for the lack of, pay increases over the last 30 years. So there's still a long way to go. You just hope that the increases are more than expected, and there's enough of those over the next 10 years to get to a level where it's somewhat fair.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is I think it was the Economic Policy Institute who came out with a study this week that said since 1978, our CEO class has seen their pay rise 1,322%, while the typical worker, people like you and me, just about 18% over that period.
Right.
And you see this great unleveling where, this giant sucking sound, to use a Ross Perot frame, of money out of our pocket to theirs. And there's got to be something there's got to be a rubber band that snaps back and goes, enough already. Well, we've got to take some of that back and turn the tide.
I think you see some of that. There is a little bit of, there is a bit of populism, even on the right, where there is a little bit of, all of a sudden, there's a realization, like, things are out of whack. And, I think of myself, since, 10, 15 years ago, part of me was kind of like, you know what, it doesn't really matter if people, they're billions, whatever. It sounds crazy, but if you want to pay Bezos that much, that's fine. As long as the working people get good wages. And yet, now I've realized, through, learning and researching it, that they're interconnected.
Yep.
So, of course, the reason that Bezos is getting so much is because so much is being transferred and sucked away from working people, from wages that they're not getting, from benefits they're not getting, that are all of a sudden being transferred over to the business class and to Wall Street.
Absolutely. And
these companies.
And, the reality is, I think EPI, I think it was EPI who said it, back in 89, right around the time when I started working, the average CEO pay was 61-1. Back in the 60s, right. It was 20-1. We're now at 351-1.
That's, which is stunning.
It's stunning. I mean, the level of greed is stunning. And I'm glad to see that there are a number of strikes going on. I think we need more strikes. I'm a supporter of workers going on strike because it shows that there are some options out there. Because, look, that's obscene. And that's a result of not having a strong, vibrant labor movement to hold these people accountable.
Right, right. And you start to see, I mean, obviously, even having an election in Alabama for Amazon and that warehouse was a big deal. And even though they lost, now having the NLRB, you know, that hearing officer basically say, go back and do it again, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That was a big moment. That actually could end up, you know, changing the results. That's possible. But even at the very least, I think it gives encouragement to other workers who wouldn't even have considered trying to organize that now they can do it.
Yeah, I'm still hoping. I'm still hoping they go, no, we're not going to run another election. We're imposing union recognition on there. You start bargaining.
Oh, right.
That's the right move right there.
But wouldn't it be better, Rick, if they just did an election and they won?
They're not going to win.
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm going to go on a limb here, and I'm going to say that there's not one person left in that Amazon facility who signed a card.
That's possible. I mean, that's probably a good guess.
Because they've got what did they say during the 150% turnover?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to me, at some point, you got to go, no, you've gamed the system long enough. You've threatened, you've intimidated, you've created this environment of intimidation. We're going to impose this. You got to start bargaining. Because after all, Alabama's a right-to-work state. People don't even have to join.
Right, right.
And for Amazon to spend $200 million to deny them that is crazy. Just absolutely crazy. But Marcus, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do over there at Capital in Maine.
Thank you.
Keep it up. I hope you'll come back again soon.
Yes, definitely. I hope you'll make it a regular thing. I love talking to you, Rick.
Outstanding.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much, Marcus. But no, I mean, the fact that they spent that kind of money, absolutely insane. It's just crazy. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.